Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Glenn Morrow. Our final album, Volume 1, is the latest album by Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help, and it's out July 17th via Bar None Records. That label is now celebrating its 40th year, and it was helmed by Morrow pretty much since its inception. He's since retired from the label, but he continues to make music with Cry for Help, and even says that he's excited for the future of the band. We talked about that, his days at Bar None, and why it's probably best to consider his group a rock and roll band. That's Glenn Morrow of Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help on Into Music coming up now. How does it feel to not be running a label after all these years?
It feels okay. It feels good. I don't have to think about the future of music anymore, which I spent a lot of time doing. I can think about it if I want to, but it's not like the high stakes of, are we going to survive, another month kind of thing. I like not having to think about music that way. I like thinking about Mixolydian scales and stuff like that now more than big data. I think it was a good time to remove myself just in terms of, I think everybody, you always feel that when you're retiring, it's not like the way it was, but the current sort of, just everything sort of about data just feels really, I don't want to say unpleasant, that's not the right word, but it's just a whole way of marketing and doing stuff that I'm a little bit less interested in than I should, I would be if I was running the label.
Yeah, that word metrics, right?
Yeah.
It's like plastics in The Graduate,
Yes, exactly. Young man, metrics. I have one word to tell you. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a weird time to be in any media at all. I mean, with these weird mergers and...
Yeah. It's kind of unrecognizable, and yet there's it's so bountiful. I mean, there's just more music than you can ever possibly digest. And when I started, it was like AM radio. When I first started listening to music, there was no FM really, or not anything that you were listening to. And there's a very limited amount of music you got exposed to for top 40. That is not the world of today. So I like the fact I'm reading about kids going back to having iPods because their choices become more limited. They have to download something, put it on the iPod, and it's a finite amount of music, and they can't get distracted by other things, just their own personal jams that they really love. I guess I'm still thinking about this stuff, but...
Yeah, I kind of started a trend for myself recently, which is that in the car, I still have a CD player. And if I go out of town, I'll take like two CDs. And it's like, that's what you're going to listen to.
Nice.
Just like the old days when you had one cassette in the car.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. But... well, let's dive in if we can to this new record. And so when did this one kind of start coming together?
Well, the last record came out in the pandemic, and I remember thinking, maybe I should wait. And then I was like, no, a lot of these songs, the songs are, it was kind of angry music and, sort of innuendos about Trump and whatnot. And it was just like, it's just, I got to put this out now before, either while he's still in office or now that he's out. I can't remember what year that was, but little did I know he'd be coming back. But yeah, so the second album, which is called Two, came out during the pandemic, and a little bit challenging doing that, but made a bunch of videos. And then this one just, yeah, we just started coming together. We're like a bowling team or something, and we get together once a week to kind of bang stuff, and you just keep banging it away till you finally feel like, ah, we got the arrangements that you like. Then we took it into the studio with Ray Ketchum, who we worked with, Ray Ketchum at Magic Door Recording, and pretty much most of it was recorded in two sessions, I think, the basic tracks, and then we, started adding some things, and then finally turned it over to Andy Burton, remarkable keyboard player who just happened to have a hole in his schedule and just would not let go of the recordings. He just kept like, oh, I got a little bit more to do. And I'd go over to his studio and, he'd be putting the Mellotron on there or, but then I just went with it. I went, well, this is going to be the keyboard heavy record. And I liked the way it came out ultimately. And some, certain things, I wrote a few songs. I wanted it to rock a little bit more. So I wrote a couple more the song into something new, and Beetle Bones came towards the end of the maybe where the newer song says I wanted a couple more upbeat things on the record.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because I was thinking about how it's a rock and roll record. Like it's almost like rock and roll itself is a lost art.
You're the second person I've talked to that brought that up, and I think I love rock and roll, and I love the idea that I'm somehow, yeah, it seemed like it was at the center, it certainly was at the center of the culture at some point, and now it's just sort of, yeah, the thread got lost. Like indie rock is based on something else, not based on rock and roll necessarily. And there's people that do very, kind of, I don't want to say slavish, but they keep to the formula of rock and roll, 1/4-5s, certain guitar riffs, keep it very tight and, very, sense retro. So I just sort of, I don't really want to do that, but I do like, yeah, you put the flavors in there and, you mix them up a little bit and, make these little Frankenstein monsters that, seem to want to have a life of their own.
So if the last album, in your estimation, was dark, this one doesn't seem quite that way to me.
I thought about it recently and I realized in some ways, probably the first time of the three records, this one love figures into virtually every song, not necessarily in the same way, but there's like over the top operatic love in what's it called? Love to Love? Is that what it's called? I can't remember the name of it. It's somewhere it just figures into every one of the songs somehow. And I don't think the other records did that necessarily. Not that it's like a mushy record, but it definitely deals with, I just turned 70, so it deals with the time that I have left, I guess, the time that's ahead, and a little bit reflective, but not too much. I'm trying to just sort out what you got left to do.
So, what did you determine?
Well, there's a line in That's That. What is it? What do you do when your race is run? You pick another pony for another one. You finish something and what, you just, you're going to roll over and die at that point? Well, maybe, but really, all you can do is just keep making stuff and doing stuff, and I don't know. That's the only secret to life I've determined. I had an uncle once years ago. I mean, I was a teenager, and he was dying, and I went and visited him. I said, "Do you have any advice?" And he just said, "Keep going." And I thought, it's so simple, and maybe it's not 100% satisfying. You want closure or something, but you never really get closure, and you just keep. You just got to keep doing stuff. And hopefully some of it resonates with people, or you at least get personal satisfaction out of it. And I'm happy now you're the second person that said something about me, whatever, keeping rock and roll alive or something there. I love the idea of rock and roll as a, I said this to the other person that, on one level, rock and roll is just a crass marketing concept, in the late 50s by people repackaging rhythm blues music and for, the white teenagers and older, maybe people a little bit older in their 20s or 30s were, and I only learned sort of from reading or thinking about my father a little bit. Like he was really into the mambo and going out, to dance halls where people would dance, and didn't have much interest in rock and roll. He was more big band and that sort of thing. And I think there were a lot of people like, ah, that's like teeny bopper music. Like that's not, there's nothing. They were into Lead Belly maybe, or bebop, or and rock and roll was just this thing kids listen to. But if you were one of those kids, you just like people a little older than me would be like, I heard Jerry Lee Lewis for the first time at Great Balls of Fire. It was just like my life changed. You hear that, or certainly the Beatles and the Stones were that way. And I think in the end, there's just something about rock and roll, even if it was a manufactured concept, that it's just some transcendental thing that's beyond just like screwing or whatever, which a lot of people said that's what rock and roll would is, but it became this other more transcendental thing to me where, you're kind of like elevated and lifted, lifted off, elevation don't go to my head by Television or 8 Miles High by the Birds. It's just this, you're, it's this force, rock and roll music can save your soul, it's maybe a different kind of religion or something, but I do believe in that sort of transcendental quality that of really great rock and roll music. And it's got to have the rock and the roll.
Tell me too, you mentioned working with Ray Ketchum, who's an accomplished musician in his own right. What made him the right person for the job?
We started working a long time ago on, I guess, some, I'm trying to remember that maybe the we worked on some projects, Bar None stuff, a bunch of different bands, Shirk Circus, Burnside Project, Chocolate USA. And we were just friends. And sometimes, I'd go up there and jam. I brought Steve Wynn up there once to play with his band Elk City, just in the studio, just playing tunes. And then when we went to do the first record, he was drumming with us just sort of to help us out. Yeah, it just was a natural. It just felt natural and right. And we recorded the first record in his house, in the basement of his house, and then he took the plunge and invested in an actual building to create the Magic Door Studio. And the second record was done there, and this new record as well.
I have to ask you about the title of the album. It would be remiss of me if I did not say in that. This is our final album, Volume 1.
I wanted to give us an out in case it wasn't our final album, and it's not necessarily our final album, but like I said, I turned 70, so my wife sort of has a theory a band can only make three good records, and then I think the Velvet Underground made four at least. And but I've got six new songs written, so anything can happen. I remember originally thinking it would be called Our Last Album. And then, because you could say, well, when we were making our last album, we were thinking about the next one. So that was sort of the idea. And then I think Rick from the band sort of tweaked that idea a little bit and came up with the Volume One idea.
Before I let you go, we started off kind of talking about your time at the, running a label. How closely did you work with bands? Was there a lot of like kind of shepherding them, mentoring them, that sort of thing?
I mean, I used to say, like, if you can find a good master that you like, that's great, because then you don't, all the work that you have to do to figure out how to make a record, who to record it with, that's a lot of work, especially with a new band. They don't necessarily know conceptually what they want. Freddie Johnson, when he started, we recorded him a bunch of tracks solo. We recorded, oh yeah, Wichita, here we are. We recorded a song called Wichita that's never come out. It's an amazing song. And then we did a whole set where he played like Brushes, like the drummer played Brushes. A couple of those things ended up on the first album, That Approach. And then, we had like, okay, let's do something really punk rock, like Little Red-Haired Girl again on the first record. So I was very involved in the first record and before, sort of passing the reins to other people after that. And actually, Chris Butler was the producer on the first record, but that was sort of my idea. Like, well, let's figure out, what is Freddie Johnson? And there's all these, he contains multitudes. And yeah, sometimes I'd be very hands-on. I liked it when an artist had a very clear vision and I didn't have to be hands-on, but if I felt I had to get under the hood, it's like, man, they don't have a hit on this record. We got to, figure out what to do. I sometimes did that. Otherwise you might end up with something that you just can't really sell, But I like the idea, like letting the artist be the artist and, supporting their artist as much as you can. Quietly nudging them when you have to. There's an artist that on the label now, Little Hag, that I really enjoyed working with her over the last since the pandemic, and just trying to figure out what kind of records to make and what she was trying to say. And she definitely went, had her own ideas that were sometimes vaguely shocking, but it was just she was just such a is just a refreshing artist to work with. That was the last time I was really under the hood. I helped bring the Bob Burt record to the label, and that was done. And it was like, Bob, you nailed it. You nailed a record that sounds like it should be on Bar None. So
What was the Little Hag album? Now that's what I call Little
now
Hag.
that's what I call Little Hag. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was so amazing.
Yeah, that was her concept, that she used to love those kind of records. That does now that's what I call records, or whatever you call them.
And nobody, this is not something that somebody taught you. This was instinct.
Yeah, I mean, you pick things up along the way, certainly. And I read certain books like the Clive Davis biography. I forget what he said. I don't know if there's any advice that I can specifically think off the top of my head that he had. I know he did a lot of middle of the road singers, and he would just say, you got to do covers because that's people, they want to hear you doing God Didn't Make Little Green Apples and It Don't Rain in Indianapolis in the summertime. They're like, everybody that was on that label did that song. He had certain songs that he thought were palatable for a middle of the road singer. And very rarely would he let them, unless they somehow had like a hit single. He didn't want to put it on the record. He wanted songs that were already hits. That's not advice I followed. But and then there was book Billion Dollar Babies about the whole management of Alice Cooper, and one called Star Maker Machinery that was about where the author took wanted to find a kind of a band that had like couple of hits, but really was just kind of struggling, working, hard working band that had, wasn't rich by any means. And he did a book using Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airman. I forget what their hit was, but it's all about the Star Maker Machinery of them trying to beef up their thing, and they're working with the producer who did American Pie for Don McLean. And anyway, that had a lot of useful. So yeah, I read a couple of books, and we literally started the label and put out Tom Prendergast started the label to put out my album back in 1986, and then I found they might be giants, and we were able to break them and get them on MTV after a year. And we thought, we were pretty naive, like we really didn't know what we were doing, and I think naivety took us pretty far, in the early days. And then, yeah, you make some mistakes, and you make every once in a while you try to make a record with somebody, you just go down the wrong route and you have to start over or abandon the project. Or it was, yeah, 40 years I did it. And Emmy Black, who's running the company right now, was born in 1986, the year Bar None started, and we have the same birthday. So I think that's kind of cool continuum there.
You've been listening to a conversation with Glenn Morrow of Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help. The band's new LP, our final album, Volume 1, is out July 17th via Bar None Records. You can learn more about that record at glennmorrowscryforhelp.com. www.bandcamp.com or at Bar None Records, bar-none.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.